Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joanne. I'm an alcoholic. Out there, it took me a while to get used to it, but the Dutchies who live in the area where I live now actually pronounce it New Tripoli. I don't know why. There's another town nearby that's spelled G-E-R-M-A-N-S-V-I-L-L-E, and they pronounce that Germansville. I don't know why. It's just, you know, Pennsylvania. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and after living in New Jersey for the bulk of my drinking career and my early sobriety, I moved back. So it's really a pleasure to be here. I came to this meeting for quite a few years and haven't been here recently. And I was commenting to Dave. Actually, when I was chairing the meeting, he was the coffee maker. And so we used to hang out in the kitchen a lot before the meeting. And it seems like it's such a far drive, and I used to do it all the time. And now it seems like it's a little farther, but I do a little farther out now. I live a little farther west than when I first moved to Pennsylvania. Just to give you a little background on me, I got sober May 11th, 1994. So it's just about 9 years and 9 months now. Looking at a smiling face in the crowd who I've been seeing since pretty much that first day, and it's really good to see him here tonight. I learned a lot in my early sobriety from him about how to work the steps. I got sober. The first time I went to rehab was in 1992, and I went to Honesty House, and I came out and went to meetings and got a sponsor, and I had a really great fellowship service sponsor, and I began to die. Because alcohol, for a really long time, fixed what was wrong with me, because I am an alcoholic. And all the things that are wrong with me were still wrong with me once I stopped drinking. And they didn't stop. And as a matter of fact, they began to get a lot worse without the treatment that I had always had for, let's see, 21 years, from the time I was 17 until I was 38, or I was 36 then. So I got worse and worse and worse, and was told that, you know, I would get around to working the steps when it was time, and she would know when it was time. And I drank. And I thought, well, that wasn't so bad. As a matter of fact, that first Friday night when I drank, I poured myself a water glass filled with vodka. I had a long, long list of resentments, but it wasn't on paper. It was still going around and around in my head, just like it always had. And there's no need to enumerate them here, because I'm sure everybody else could, you know, give me their top 10, and it would be pretty similar. Started off with husband, and I started to drink, and I just poured myself that water glass filled with vodka and then poured myself another, and I don't remember anything else from that night. But I woke up the next morning, and being an alcoholic, the first thing I said in my hangover state was, that's it, from now on we're buying better vodka. Because I knew that I didn't want to be hungover like that. I didn't want to feel bad anymore. I was tired of feeling bad. And I convinced myself that, you know, since I had been, you know, dry for a period of time, this time it would be different. And about 2 weeks later, about 2 weeks later, I drank again on a Friday night. I still thought that I had it under control. This turned into about 6 months of really good, hard drinking. And when I came back to Honesty House, I called up my counselor one day, and I said, I need to come in. And she said to me, I heard you were out. When can you get here? And she's the most loving, sweet, kind example of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous I have ever met, other than my current sponsor, of course. And Alice said to me, just get here. And I had already been drinking that day. And I said, well, you know, being, you know, a typical alcoholic, I was like, well, okay, you know, I'm already drinking, so I'll come in tomorrow, you know. The next morning I drove myself the 8 miles from my house to Honesty House, which, if any of you remember, was in Sterling. And had to pull over twice as I was driving there because I had the dry heaves. I was physically addicted to alcohol at that point. I had to have alcohol to function, and I'm making little quotes in the air normally, because I was addicted to alcohol. I had to drink booze to get okay. You know, there wasn't any okay for me without booze. Just to get okay, I had to drink. And I drank more and more and more, trying to get okay and trying not to hear the voices in my head anymore. And for me, that's the essence of my alcoholism, was the fact that at that point in my drinking career, I could no longer quiet those voices in my head. I was either somewhere in that haze of being an alcoholic, where I was either hungover and throwing up. I was throwing up blood in the morning. And then I would drink one drink and throw that up. I would try to keep as much of it down as I could because I knew I needed the booze in my blood system. And then I would probably be able to keep the second one down. And then I would go about my day. And I thought because I still went to work every day and I was still earning good money that I was a functioning alcoholic, that everything was, you know, I had things under control, sort of. But I knew at this point, on May 10th of 1994, that I was done. And I can say quite honestly that I am so grateful that I was given the gift of hopelessness. Because I think until the alcoholic reaches that point where I was totally hopeless, that I knew that I couldn't ever do anything with my life under my own power. I had to reach that point. And when I hear people talk about high bottoms and low bottoms, I really don't understand it, because if you're a true alcoholic and you've hit that point of hopelessness where you know that you're out of options, that in and of yourself and all your plans and schemes, you're done. Everything you've ever tried before hasn't worked. That if you've gotten to that point, then you're at the bottom. If you know that you can't do it on your own ever, and you come, hopefully, to Alcoholics Anonymous and you find a good group that has people in it who have higher powers, who understand what it means to get sober and to stay sober and to use a higher power, as I learned, then you've reached your bottom. That's really the true bottom, I believe, for an alcoholic. And when I start to work with other women, I talk with them about that and about how that's really the beginning point, and that's step one. I was given a copy of this book in rehab. I was very fortunate in the rehab that I went. The only staff that were hired were recovered alcoholics. The woman who was my counselor was 17 years sober on the big book. I was given a copy of this book, and she told me to start reading it from the beginning. I said, well, what about that How It Works thing they all read? She said, read it from the beginning. I said, well, what do you mean from the beginning? And she said, from the beginning. So, being a good alcoholic and not following directions, I started at chapter one instead of at the beginning. I skipped over, you know, all that forward stuff. You never read that part in a book anyway. So I'm reading Bill's story, and I go to her the next day, and I say, ha, that's him. That's my husband to a T. Boy, did they have his number. She said, okay, now go and read it for yourself. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, just read it and see if there's anything you can identify with. I read it again. I still saw my husband. And then I got to this chapter that I'm going to talk about tonight, There Is a Solution. And I started to have some hope. And I think for me, that's the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, even today, is the fact that no matter what's going on in my life, and no matter how bad I feel, no matter how sorry for myself or how full of pity I am, and how hopeless I feel in my current situation, in that moment, in that day, in that week, in that weekend, Alcoholics Anonymous for me still is hopeful. You know, I may go to meetings where I don't like what they talk about. I wonder if any of them are on the program. I can't imagine what they're doing and why they're calling it an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, because they're only talking about drugs. You know, and all these kind of things can happen for me, but 9 times out of 10, 10 times out of 10, I'll see somebody there that I know, that I have, you know, a connection with, you know, and I can talk with them a little while. Or there'll be somebody there who's there's a newcomer there. There's a woman there, and this is her first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I can go and I can talk to her, and I can share with her what I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've learned about how to live life without booze through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can start to see the glimmer of the possibility that there might be something else besides the desperate situation that she's in at that moment. And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what Alice gave me, was that glimmer of the possibility that maybe if I tried this thing, it could work for me too. So we read There Is a Solution. I'm on page 27. If anybody has their book with them, or 17. Page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. I said, what do you mean recovered? What does recovered mean? I hear these people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about recovery and how they're always recovering. What is this? I don't understand. And it tells me they have solved the drink problem. And I'm like, well, how do you do that? Isn't that amazing? Because I knew I was an alcoholic and I knew I was hopeless. I couldn't imagine how they had solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. I was that. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented. And it goes on to describe what has become what I know of this fellowship. In this fellowship, I have met people who have tons more money than me. I've met people who have less money than me. I've met men. I've met women. Different races, different religions. And the only thing that we have to worry about when we're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that we're alcoholics. And that's what binds us together, is that we're alcoholics, and the rest of it doesn't matter. And this is one of the truly, for me, democratic societies. This is the only one that I know of in the world. And it's amazing to be a part of it and to have that sisterhood and brotherhood with other people. We're people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And I found that to be a beautiful promise for me. I couldn't imagine when I was new, when I was just coming off of drinking, having friendship and camaraderie with people anymore. I had people that I sat with at the bar, and we complained about everything. But there wasn't any joy, there wasn't any camaraderie, there wasn't any friendliness. Certainly once I stopped drinking, they didn't call me on the phone to find out where I was or what I was doing. Unless I owed the money. We're like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. And I definitely felt that I had been rescued, that Alcoholics Anonymous had rescued me. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is but one element in the power to cement that binds us. And it talks about this. And the common pearl, obviously, is our alcoholism, but it's only one element in the powerful cement which binds us. That in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. And I love the fact that when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sit down and I find people, I find other women that I can talk with one-on-one. I recently met a gal who moved from Bethlehem to from Texas. And when I met her at a midday meeting, and her name is Christina. And we started chatting, and she's only been sober for about a year and a half, and she got sober in a big book group in Texas. And as soon as she started going to meetings in the valley, I live in the Lehigh Valley, people kept saying to her, "You've got to meet Joanne, you've got to meet Joanne, you've got to meet Joanne. Have you met Joanne yet? You've got to meet Joanne." And she's like, "No," you know, because I guess I have that, you know, big book thing, you know, name. So I met her, and we've become really good friends. And, you know, she's married, I'm not. She's having a child, I never had any kids. We had different careers. She hangs out at, you know, the country club, and her husband has a really big job, and I don't. I'm going to school again. You know, I mean, there's really, you know, but we're both on this spiritual path together. And I can call her and I can talk to her about just about anything that's going on inside my deepest, deepest heart. Things when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I would never have told my closest friend, my sister, who I knew all my life, she's older than I am, or my husband, whom I had been married to for 10 years. I mean, there's things that I wouldn't tell them, that I feel I could call Christina on the phone and say, "Hey, this is going on. I need to talk about this. What's happening?" You know, and right away, we're right there on the same page. And that's that kind of camaraderie and friendship that I enjoy today in Alcoholics Anonymous. And these aren't even the people that I've known for 9 or 10 years. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So I guess at this point, what you need to decide is, are you an alcoholic? In the doctor's opinion, we talked about being an alcoholic and what that means. An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness. I was surprised to find out it was an illness. I thought I was morally deficient. And I thought that God was punishing me. So I had this like really skewed view of my relationship, of myself, between myself and the universe. For the alcoholic, the alcoholism engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. And I had to look at my life and decide whether or not there were any relationships in my life that were still intact. And I had to agree that yes, I had obviously been, as my friend Jerry calls it, a spirit killer. Everybody who I had talked to, that I had become involved with, whose life had touched mine, whose life had touched my life, I had done something to them that killed their spirit in some way, shape, or form. And here I'm given in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous a method to repair that damage. And for me, that was a beautiful, wonderful promise that I was going to be able to do that. And I embarked on this path. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. In the italics, it talks about the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with the facts about herself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And I was very fortunate because I was sitting there with Alice, and Alice was talking to me about the way she had drank. And I understood. For the first time, she was putting words to how I felt, how I thought, and what I had been doing with my life. Words that I had never had before. I never could describe what was going on inside me. I knew I had this vague sense that there was something that wasn't quite right. I thought at the end that I was pretty much insane, but not really crazy. But I just didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking because everything, every fiber of my being, physically, would cry out for the alcohol. And even after I had been dry for 10 months, mentally, I still craved the alcohol. And that was the crux of the problem for me. And here was this woman sitting in front of me, explaining to me what had happened to her 18 years before that, and the state that she had been in. And she was describing to me exactly where I was that day. And it amazed and astounded me that someone could do that. And I looked at her, and I had to believe that she was telling me the truth, because nobody could describe my internal condition and not have experienced it. But as I looked at her, she's a person who's filled with joy of life. She's absolutely radiant with the spirit of living. I thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world. But I've come to understand that that is that spirit of life that we regain as we work this program. As life comes back into us, as the dead parts are taken away, and they're replaced with life and with joy. I know that now, but back then all I knew was that that was what I wanted to be like. I wanted to feel that way about life again, because I wanted to die and I couldn't die. I couldn't drink myself to death. I couldn't end the pain, but I wanted it to stop. And that's what I knew about my alcoholism. And within a matter of a few hours, she gained my confidence, much as it says here. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what she is talking about, that her whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that she is a woman with a real answer, that she has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. And for me, this was effective. That was the experience that I had with that first sponsor. And as I sponsor other women, it's my pleasure to give that back, to be able to transmit that message to other women who are suffering the way I was suffering. It goes on to say that we feel the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in that sort of effort, which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all of their time to the work. When I read that, it scared me a little bit. It still scares me a little bit. Because I know that I'm not capable of doing these things on my own. I need help. And I found that help through working the steps and from the fellowship. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met all of the women who have been kind enough to sponsor me in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met all of the women that God has been good enough to give me to share this program with in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've tried other methods. I've given every single doctor I've ever gone to, I've given a copy of the Big Book and my phone number, and asked him and asked him and or her to let me know if they ever think that they have someone that needs help or who asks for help. I've never gotten a referral that way. But in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we're bound by the common problem and the common solution, I found the fellowship that I craved all of my life. And for me, that's what's so wonderful about coming to these rooms. And let me see, what else do we want to talk about? At the bottom of 19, it begins to talk about some of the things that we need to do in order to work the steps. If indeed we're interested in trying this thing, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions or attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. This is, that little paragraph is something that I pray every morning. One of the things that I ask as soon as I wake up in the morning is, how can I be of service? Because I know that if I continue to run around in my own self-centered little world and just worry about what does Joanne have to do today and how am I going to get what I want and how am I going to do what I want to do and how am I going to see who I want to see and, you know, all that kind of stuff, that pretty soon that leads me down the wrong road. And the answer for this alcoholic is to constantly be thinking of others instead of thinking of myself. You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. I didn't understand until Howard explained it to me that this is a textbook. And if I wanted to learn how to live my life successfully, I would be able to follow the directions in this book, and that would give me the answers. When I first did the steps, I was incapable of reading. I was very fortunate in that it was explained to me how to do the steps. And I wrote my fourth step, and I did my first fifth step when I was 12 days sober. On my 22nd day, I left the rehab with the instructions that I used to find out a sponsor and continue with working the steps. In my fourth week, I made my first two amends, which were to my my sister, who was closest to me in age and who had borne most of the horror of my alcoholism. She received most of the effects, and for that I was appalled with myself, afraid to confront her with the truth, because I had been lying to her for so long about so many things. And I was deeply ashamed of what I had done. And that was the first person I made amends with. Second person, on the same day, was the man who had just fired me from my job. I got fired after I left rehab. I came back to work, and they gave me medical clearance and then released me. I was medically cleared to go back to work, and then I was laid off the same day. And I went to that man a few days later, and the man who had been responsible for documenting my performance over quite a long period of time, and I went and I made amends to him because it had been such a waste of his talent, his time, and what he could have been contributing to society, and instead he had to waste his time following me around and documenting what I was up to. And for that, I was, again, ashamed and truly felt that I owed a debt to society because of that. And that was in about my fourth week of sobriety. You may have heard from other people that, you know, if you do your steps in rehab, it doesn't count. 9 years, 9 months later, I'm still sober. That wasn't the only time I worked the steps. But it was 2 years before I was able to read this book, because I was that physically damaged from alcohol. I'm not saying I couldn't read. I could read out loud. But that I didn't. But you asked me, you know, a split second later what I just said, and I had no idea. And I had no memory, number one, and then comprehension. And what was that word? You know, I was shot. I was just plain shot, you know. But I continued to go to meetings, and I continued to do the work as it had been explained to me by my sponsor. And I'm very lucky that I was given the directions as they're in this book. You know, I hear people say, don't let anybody read your big book for you. I didn't have much choice. And I'm glad that I got a clear and concise vision of what needed to be done. And I started going to this step meeting up at the Shrine. It's a 12 and 12 meeting. And I went there every Saturday morning and started listening to people talk about, you know, their experience with work in this. And I started to find out that I got a lot more out of meetings where they actually read some of the literature. They didn't just, like, you know, talk about whatever happened to be on their mind that day, especially those 5:30 meetings. That's always real interesting after a long, hard day of work. And I was given the gift of some really great guides along the way. I listened to a lot of tapes as well. I listened to the big book on tape, which is also available. I had a lot of trouble with reading, so I would listen to it on tape, and I spent a lot of time in the car, so I used to listen to a lot of tapes, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I still do it today. There's times when I can't get to a meeting. But, you know, when I'm commuting home from work, I can get a really great meeting in that 30 minutes that I'm sitting on the highway and hear some really great inspirational stuff. So I did my steps for the first time really early in sobriety. I continue to try to work them. And as I did, my relationship with God began to change. When I took the third step in 1994, Alice had said to me, well, just, you know, because I had this, like, really bad relationship with God. I was mostly trying to hide out from him because I didn't want him to catch me, because I knew I was really bad. And he had already done enough stuff to punish me for all this stuff I was doing. And I figured, you know, as long as I wasn't talking to him, you know, maybe he was, you know, pretending I wasn't there anymore too. I've since found out that just because I'm ignoring him doesn't mean he's left the room. He's still here. So, it was suggested to me that I just start to think about what it would be like if I could have the best friend I could imagine, and to make that my conception of my higher power. And that's how I began. I started to think of God, and I thought a lot about the Lord's Prayer that we say, sometimes at the end of a meeting. And that was how I began with my conception of my higher power at the beginning. And I can remember when I took the third step, feeling all of a sudden as though I was sitting in my father's lap and he had his arms wrapped around me and everything was going to be okay. Because it was explained to me that the third step says to place my life and my will in the care of God as I understand him, in his care. And I began to trust just a little bit that maybe it was possible. That things could change. That I didn't have to stay the way I was. That I could change, which I couldn't imagine. But here was a living, breathing example of what had happened sitting in front of me. And I began to believe that if I tried this process, these steps, that it could happen for me too. So I took the third step. And then as I continued through the rest of the steps, I was strongly reminded that I didn't have the power to do the steps, that I needed to ask for help, because I don't have the power to do these things on my own. I, you know, still have to ask for help. And as I work the steps, and I continue to work them, I get more help each time I ask. And for me, that is the essence of the relationship that I have with God today. My higher power is always here for me. He's always here to help me whenever anything happens in my life. If I ask. Because I have a very polite God. He waits for me to ask. He's a very wise God as well, and I don't always get what I want. I need to kind of take things as they are and let Him take over. And, you know, for me, in the beginning, and even today, that can be such a relief that I don't have to worry about every little thing because it's going to be taken care of. And one of the great things about being sober for a while is that I can look back at some evidence in my own life now. You know, things are never real clear to me when I'm in the middle of them. Things are never real clear to me when I'm in the middle of them. It's always when I kind of look back on them that I begin to see what was happening and what's unfolding. I was out with my boyfriend, the guy that I live with. I guess it was Valentine's Day. And I was talking about how rough it had been for me a couple of years ago when I was when I had first moved to Pennsylvania, and I was working a lot of hours and I was commuting a lot. I was driving a lot, and I worked pretty much. I would leave my house at about 6 or 7 a.m. and I wouldn't get home until 10 or 11 at night, and I would get up the next day and do the same thing. And it went on and on and on. For 22 months like that. And during that time period, however, I made some money. And I was able to purchase the home that I bought when I moved to Pennsylvania. And because I was working so much, I had to hire a lot of people to come and do work in the house. I hired somebody to come in and paint. I hired somebody to clean. And eventually I got to the point where I needed to hire a landscaper. It's 5 acres. It was 5-acre property. And this man that I currently live with was one of the landscapers that showed up. He's not an alcoholic either. My friend Chris over there says, oh, Joanne, you know, he's an Al-Anon. It's great. You know, you've got the perfect relationship. You're both in love with the same person. And I say, yeah. Works for me. But, you know, it just amazes me as I look back, you know, over, you know, a period of 5 years, you know, I never would have thought that that was going to be what was going to happen. And that's what happened, you know. You know, and when, you know, when we met, I didn't think that there was, you know, any chance that, this guy was, you know, right for me. And I have found so much peace and so much calm and such a different lifestyle now, where I live now. I moved farther into the country, as a matter of fact. We built a new home and moved farther into the country. And it's so different from the life that I lived, you know, 6 or 7 years ago when I was here in the rat race of North Jersey. you know, out where I live. Now, you know, if there's like 3 cars in front of you at the stop sign, it's like, oh, look at all this traffic, you know. When I first moved there, you know, and I'd be in the car with somebody, they'd be like, they'd say something like that, and I'd be like, well, you could see why you're stopped. Like, you know, don't you understand? Like, you can, like there was such a difference from, you know, being in, you know, Bridgewater, you know, where you could be stopped for 45 minutes and never know why, you know, just stuck, you know. But it's such a different life that God has planned for me than what I had possibly ever could possibly have planned for myself. And it's so much more than what I thought was possible. And let me see if there's anything. On page 25, it says, there is a solution. Almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation or finish. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. To me, as I read that right now, I love the set-aside prayer. I just had a new experience with that sentence. And I have to remember that when I'm procrastinating on writing inventory, I have to remember that there is a solution to the hopelessness and futility of life as I am living it. Today, right now, you know, if I'm not in a good spot, it's because there's something that I'm not willing to do. And there is a solution, and it's still here. And that's why I stick around. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish things for us which we could never do by ourselves. So I can tell you that for me, this is what happened. And this is what continues to happen as I continue to work through this process and continue to stay close to this fellowship, stay close to working the steps. It's not work. It's only work when I procrastinate. And in my mind, then it's work. Because I make so much out of it when I don't do it. And when I do it, it's all so simple and it makes life so much easier. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and that could be through using drink, using alcohol or other chemicals, or it could be through, you know, I hear people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about emotional blackouts or mental blackouts, or, you know, we just choose to ignore it, pretend it's going to go away, be like an ostrich with our head in the sand. We can do these things when we're not drinking. This doesn't just apply to us back in our drinking careers. These things can apply to us today. If we think that something's just going to go away, and it keeps coming up, and it keeps coming up, and it keeps coming up, and then we meet somebody new, and it looks like it's the same thing all over again, maybe we just need to sit down and go through the process about that one little situation. And the other was to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. So I guess I'll close with asking that I be given the humility to allow that my ego, which these days seems to take the form of procrastination, can be let go of, so that I can once again continue to do this process. When things are bugging me, that I'll sit down and I'll do the writing. I'll call somebody on the phone, talk it over with them, and continue through the steps as I need to. And remember always that God is with me. Even if I'm trying to ignore him, he hasn't left the room. And I want to thank this group for asking me to speak. It's really great to be here. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.